Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're going to have just such a briefing for a full hour today with a man whose intelligence I've come to admire greatly, his acumen, particularly with respect to the business of the counter jihad, is, well, practically unparalleled in America today. He is Patrick Poole. You can find his writings regularly at PJ Media, where he does extraordinary work as really an investigative reporter on terrorism and national security issues. But he's deeply knowledgeable in these subjects. His counsel has been sought by those in government at Capitol Hill and elsewhere. And, of course, we're always thrilled to have his participation in our program. Patrick, welcome, and thank you for giving us generously of your time today.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with kind of a parable, almost. Yesterday, the President of the United States made his first visit to a mosque in this country. And he chose, of all of the mosques that he could have gone to, the Islamic Society of Baltimore. I'd like to kind of tease out with you, Patrick Poole, as a man who knows a lot about both the mosques in this country and the relationships that many of them have with organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood, to figure out whether this was a bad choice by the president, perhaps emblematic of kind of a series of bad choices he's been making in this space. What do you think?
Well, Frank, I do think that this is kind of emblematic of the failure of the Obama administration's countering violent extremism, or CVE, policies, which, in fairness, also go back to the latter half of the Bush administration, where we see this engagement with really bad, I mean, known bad actors in the Muslim community, promoting them as moderates that are supposedly going to help us de-radicalize. Well, yet, in fact, we're seeing, from an empirical point of view, we're seeing more terror arrests now than we've ever seen before.
And not much thanks to these guys, as best I can tell, the partners in this outreach process.
I think there are a couple things with this Baltimore mosque visit by Obama. First off is that Obama has to go to Baltimore to find, a location that's not going to be problematic. He couldn't go directly across the Potomac River to Dar al-Hijra, one of the largest mosques on the East Coast, because it's hard. Terror tied up to its eyeballs. I mean, there have been more than a dozen, as I've reported at PJ Media previously, on Dar al-Hijra. You've just got this stream of terrorists, including their former imam, Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed in a CIA drone strike as the senior al-Qaeda leader. And then they couldn't go to the Adams Center in Herndon, Virginia, because with Mohammed Majid, Obama's pal Mohammed Majid, where a number of U.S. officials have traipsed up to and held press events, because his mosque has churned out several terrorists here over the past couple years. Same thing with the mosque in College Park. So, I mean, that Obama has to go 70 miles away from the White House to find a mosque that could even be spun up as non-problematic is a problem in and of itself. And then you have the Baltimore Mosque.
Before we get to the Baltimore Mosque in more detail, but Patrick, as you've just pointed out, several of the mosques that have been prominent in the Washington region for some time are – In fact, entities with which the administration has engaged in the previous administration, as you say. But interestingly enough, the longtime imam of the mosque in Baltimore, a gentleman by the name of Muhammad Adam El-Sheikh, apparently spent time at the very mosque you're talking about, Dar al-Hijra, as well. In other words, problematic there, too. But talk, if you would, a little bit about the Islamic societies in this country, Patrick, and what we know about their relationship to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, Frank, as Steve Coughlin points out in his book published by the Center for Security Policy, the Islamic Society is basically a brand name for the Muslim Brotherhood operating here in the United States. And we even see this in the Muslim Brotherhood documents, which the Justice Department entered into evidence during the Holy Land Foundation trial. So, you know, when we see Islamic Society, it immediately should, you know, pop up that, hey, you know, this is a Muslim Brotherhood related mosque. And in fact, we have the longtime imam who you were just talking about, Adam El-Sheikh. The Washington Post actually identified back in 2004, Muhammad El-Sheikh is a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood in Sudan. And not only that, while he was the imam at the mosque there in Baltimore, he was also the regional director for the Islamic American Relief Agency, which was designated a terrorist organization back in 2004 for funding Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. So, Patrick, what I guess is coming across to those listening to this account is that the Obama administration may not have reached out in this instance to some of the people that it has in the past reached out to, some of the mosques, some of the Muslim Brotherhood front organizations, but they've chosen another one that just happens to be a little further removed. And I guess what I'm interested in mostly is, what does that tell us about the larger policy? You've indicated that we've been taking instruction from some of these very problematic people about how to avoid radicalization. Does this essentially mean, as a guy who's a serious professional in this space, that we've been suborned, not just penetrated, but actually suborned by enemy operatives?
Well, Frank, I think we'd be hard pressed to find another scenario in which the bad guys are more embedded inside our system than what we have today. And again, I'm a bipartisan critic in this regard. We had Republicans who were pushing the Muslim Brotherhood back in 2007, 2008, including the Bush administration. Officials within the Bush administration, the CIA, the State Department. And we see the reporting that's now coming out of the Middle East, where the Brotherhood is now openly, I mean, kind of dropped the pretense of their supposed nonviolence, and are in places like Libya are openly affiliating with Al Qaeda and with the Islamic State, and so. That our policies here inside the United States have been gravitating towards our countering violent extremism policies, have basically embraced these groups that overseas are now openly engaged with the bad guys. I mean, it's which, of course, a number of us have been, you know, warning about for more than a decade that this was a problem. But now we're seeing it work out. And we're seeing the problem proliferating at an exponential rate here inside the United States in terms of radicalization and jihadization.
Right. Patrick, we have to pause for a minute here. I just want to say what you've just described is really the nub of the issue, it seems to me. This imputing to the Muslim Brotherhood a commitment to nonviolence, which makes them acceptable partners, not only acceptable partners, but people that we want to empower and embrace and legitimate and, frankly, even arm because they somehow are on the right side in this difficult problem with the violent jihadists. When we come back, we're going to drill down on that question. What is the Muslim Brotherhood actually up to, and have they eaten our lunch? That and more with Patrick Poole of PJ Media right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleischer with the Center for Security Policy. The newest twist in the Hillary Clinton email scandal was the discovery of top-secret SAP material in unclassified emails on her private email server. SAP stands for Special Access Program. This was extremely sensitive information above the top-secret level, the compromise of which could cause loss of life and severe damage to U.S. national security. This was not the first report of classified information on Clinton's server. So what are the chances that hostile intelligence services hacked Clinton's email server? Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates thinks the odds are pretty high that countries like Iran, China, and Russia did hack this server. So how did this happen? The reason is that Hillary Clinton didn't think laws on official email and protecting classified information applied to her. If elected president this fall, Clinton will bring the same kind of dangerous arrogance to the White House. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Patrick Poole, an investigative reporter and national security analyst par excellence on matters especially involving counterterrorism and the jihad that is the principal focus of counterterrorism efforts, or should be, should I say. Patrick, we were talking before the break about the visit to the mosque that the president's made with just the latest example of an embrace, implicit if not explicit, by his administration of the Muslim Brotherhood. And you were helping to explain to us what the Brotherhood's actual attitude is towards violence, but maybe you could put it in the context of its goals, as they make no bones about. What are their goals, and is there an appreciable difference between those they share and those of, say, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, Boko Haram, or the rest?
Frank, as we've laid out in our book, Sharia the Threat, the Muslim Brotherhood's endgame is identical to that of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and a number of these other terrorist groups, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab, and that's to reestablish the caliphate and to impose Sharia law in place of, quote, man-made law. And so they're unashamed about that. They put it on their official website that this is their goals. And we saw last year, just a little over a year ago, where we had the State Department receive a Muslim Brotherhood delegation inside the State Department headquarters in Foggy Bottom there in Washington, D.C. And the very next day, the Muslim Brotherhood published on their official website a call for jihad against the Egyptian government, and invoking its terrorist past, going back to the secret apparatus and, the killing of Westerners. And, of course, I did the interview with Sheikh Nabil Naeem in Cairo last year, and I've got video of that up at pjmedia.com, where one of the founders of Egyptian Islamic Jihad. And the series of questions that I go walk through with Sheikh Nabil is about the connection between the Brotherhood and terrorism.
Our guest is Patrick Poole of PJ Media, and we're talking about the Obama administration's systematic outreach, and to some extent that of its predecessor, to the wrong Muslims, and what a problem that is. And Patrick, you were talking about kind of the actual ambitions and tactical preferences, subject to change depending on circumstance, of the Muslim Brotherhood and its friends. Please complete that thought.
Well, yeah, I was talking about the interview I did with Egyptian Islamic Jihad founder Sheikh Nabil Naeem. And Sheikh Nabil said unequivocally that he thought that the Brotherhood was the most dangerous organization out there. Because they engage in this doublespeak, and they have no reservations. We see a lot of this hand-wringing in the Western media about, well, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood has lost control of the youth. But in fact, when we look at the youth cadres of the Brotherhood, this is exactly what they're trained to do. You know, they're trained to engage in violence. And in fact, some of the crackdowns back in the last decade, in 2005, 2007, were because the Muslim Brotherhood youth cadres were engaging in these military parades around Cairo.
Yeah. Patrick, let me just ask you to pause on that for a moment, because I really want to speak at length with you about what's going on in Egypt, what's been going on in Egypt, and what we need to be understanding or its implications for us, because you've spent a lot of time there lately. But before we just leave our own situation, I just wanted to draw you out on a petition that was put on the Obama administration's official White House website. You know, this is part of their public outreach effort, I guess, to invite petitions. Well, one was put up there calling on the president to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization for the sorts of reasons that you've just mentioned. And something on the order of 200,000 Americans signed on to that petition. And it took the administration a while to get around to it. But as I recall, maybe a year after they started this thing, and long after it reached the threshold that they're supposed to respond to, they came back and said, well, we see no evidence that the Muslim Brotherhood has abandoned its commitment to nonviolence, or words to that effect. You've just laid out a pretty compelling case that that's fraud. That's actually not true, and that what the administration is doing by continuing to embrace these guys is actually quite perilous to us in this country, not just in places like Egypt as well.
Yeah, Frank, the claim that the Brotherhood had somehow eschewed violence, as James Clapper told Congress here back several years ago, and that they were a largely secular organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, it is basically this.
Our
this
top
narrative.
Intelligence officer in the United States government. Let's be
right.
Clear.
it's a narrative that exists almost exclusively within Western academic and think tank circles. I mean, it's never been true. And you go overseas and you meet with the Egyptians. You know, we met with some high-ranking level Libyans, where again, just here within the past 2 weeks, Ashraq al-Wasat, the Saudi-run newspaper, ran a pretty extensive article about the Muslim Brotherhood's proposed merger with Ansar al-Sharia, al-Qaeda, and the Islamic State in Libya. In Benghazi, and the Muslim Brotherhood has long time been in alliance with Ansar al-Sharia, the group that attacked our consulate in Benghazi. And you have the head of the Muslim Brotherhood in Yemen, Abdul Majid, who is a designated terrorist, identified by the Treasury Department as a bin Laden mentor and supporter. And he's the head of the Al-Isla party in Yemen, the Muslim Brotherhood's party in Yemen. So, I mean, we can go through, all these Muslim Brotherhood affiliates, and, you know, getting back to the change.org petition, Senator Ted Cruz, who just won the Iowa caucuses here earlier this week, he put forward a bill in the Senate calling for the designation of the Brotherhood. And the findings of that bill go through the U.S. government statements on the Brotherhood, fingering the Brotherhood for terrorism. And it's going to be interesting to see, and some surprising individuals such as Orrin Hatch have co-sponsored the Senate bill, and Mario Diaz-Balart is the sponsor of the bill in the House side. And, you know, the findings of the bill just say, hey, this is what the U.S. government has already said about the Muslim Brotherhood, including what the Justice Department has said in federal court.
Right. So what's so bizarre about this, Patrick Poole, and nobody's really chronicled this in certainly the press as well as you, there is this fundamental disconnect between the facts as we know them or have the ability to know them and what the U.S. government has been doing with respect to the Brotherhood, in part dressed up on this idea that they're nonviolent and therefore people we can do business with, but in part is simply because, I guess, they think that when they hear these guys talking about their commitment to, you know, preventing radicalization and maintaining good relations with the Muslim community, that they've found their partners for a sort of Muslim outreach program that is, in fact, at the end of the day, a fraud, and one that will get, I'm afraid, more Americans killed. We're going to talk more about that with Patrick Poole right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Any day now, a political warfare operation masquerading as a charitable organization focused on civil rights will demonstrate its true colors. The Southern Poverty Law Center will reportedly designate my Center for Security Policy as a hate group. That smear seems to serve the interests of Islamic supremacists, since it is clearly intended to suppress our freedom of speech. As a result, an entity that was once known for protecting our fundamental freedoms is now actively engaged in silencing those who warn of new assaults on our liberties. It's not hate to love freedom and to work to protect it from all enemies, foreign and domestic. The Center for Security Policy proudly opposes the Southern Poverty Law Center's enabling of the real hate mongers, jihadist mosques, schools, and other Muslim Brotherhood fronts. Every American should do the same. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Our guest is Patrick Poole. He is one of the stars of the lineup at PJ Media. He reports brilliantly on matters involving national security and counterterrorism. He has a deep understanding of jihadism, the perpetrators, the doctrine of Sharia that underpins it, and the threat that it poses to us, whether it's being wielded in an overt, violent manner or, as the Brotherhood has called it, through civilization jihad. He was one of the co-authors of a book that I'm very proud of, the Center for Security Policy's Sharia, The Threat to America. And Patrick, we've, I think, been very usefully discussing how the administration, and for that matter, the Bush administration before it, got bollocksed on embracing the wrong Muslims. I'd like to just talk a little bit about an experience that we've learned of recently from Philip Haney, a former Customs and Border Protection Patrol officer who recently retired and has talked about an investigation of a group that most of us had never heard of, but I'm sure you're familiar with, Tablighi Jamaat. And I'd like to just sort of get your sense of his accounts of what happened to that investigation and whether it may in fact have contributed to failure to stop an act of terrorism in San Bernardino.
Well, in fact, we talk about Tablighi Jamaat in the Sharia the Threat book, which we had published a couple years ago, and they're one of the largest Islamic organizations in the world. They typically hold the largest annual international Islamic event every year, these are not, you know, obscure players, and you know, according to the testimony of Phil Haney, that he was asked to conduct an investigation into the terror connections of the Tablighi Jamaat, and which in fact he did, and he ended up receiving an award for it, and then the Civil Rights Civil Liberties Division their DHS intervened and shut the investigation down. And then
and the State Department, as I understand it, a large number of lawyers from state under Hillary Clinton.
And ended up shutting the investigation down. And, of course, there's, you know, whole elements of what exactly was going on, reporting from the Washington Free Beacon and Senator Charles Grassley here more than a year ago about a terrorist hands-off list, which was signed by both Hillary Clinton and Janet Napolitano. You know, I think there's a lot here that Congress just hasn't really picked up on. You know, they've been, you know, the more sexy Benghazi investigation and things of that sort. But I mean, this really gets to the fundamental elements of our national security policy and how we've been undermined by our own policies. And we see the net result in the proliferation of these domestic terrorists. I mean, right here at home, while they're engaged in these outreach efforts. There was an Associated Press article here earlier this week talking about the countering violent extremism policies as part of the White House's outreach efforts in Minnesota. Well, I mean, the Minneapolis-St. Paul, the Twin Cities area, has been one of the most active recruiting grounds for jihad, and there's no signs of it abating, you know, despite these this White House program. And you read the article, and they filed for grant money. I'm looking at the article now, $400,000 being administered, and they're talking basically about midnight basketball. And I mean, things that are, you know, maybe good things in and of themselves, but they have absolutely nothing to do with diminishing the Islamic terror threat here inside the United States.
Patrick, you understand that terrorism threat, I think, probably as well as anybody, certainly anybody who's reporting on these issues. Why would you say that? Why is it that at the end of the day, engaging these, you know, Sharia-adherent Muslims, whether they're from Somalia, as in Minnesota, or from other parts of the Muslim world, or whether they're, you know, people who've been here for a generation or two, but nonetheless embrace this program. Why is it that midnight basketball or other blandishments like it are unlikely to change them from their course of jihad?
Well, I think, and all you need to do is ask the Muslims in these communities, you know, what exactly the problem is. And, you know, I've been up to Minneapolis. I've met with some of the Muslim community leaders there. Like Abdirizak Bihi, whose nephew was recruited into al-Shabaab and killed in Somalia. And they make no bones about the problem are some very identifiable mosques up there. You know, the Abu Bakr al-Siddiqui Mosque. You had staff members who've been convicted of recruiting for al-Shabaab and other, you know, other mosques, you know, with respect to the Islamic State. There's one case where the one of the kids who was going to go fight for the Islamic State, he was dropped off at the mosque, you know, in and that's straight out of the indictment.
Now, would this by any chance have been a Muslim Brotherhood associated mosque or a mosque that might have gotten funding from the North American Islamic Trust, a Muslim Brotherhood Saudi pass-through?
Well, in that case, it doesn't identify which mosque it was in terms of the indictment. It just says that he was dropped off at the mosque. But we know that these, you know, mosques like Abu Bakr al-Siddiqui up in Minneapolis are, you know, affiliated with the Brotherhood and have long time been affiliated with the Somali Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Ittihad al-Islamiyah, which became the Islamic Courts Union, which its youth division was al-Shabaab. So, I mean, we can trace the lineage here.
So, Patrick, can I just ask you to, speaking of the lineage, put this kind of all in context. You have violent jihad on the one hand, and you've established, I think, persuasively that the Muslim Brotherhood, among many other Islamic supremacist groups, has no problem with engaging in it where they think they can. And then you've got this other piece that the Brotherhood is, as you've indicated, calls civilization jihad, that is kind of a stealthy sort of subversive activity that you do when you're not strong enough to engage in the violent kind. And these mosques and Islamic societies and Islamic cultural centers and other front groups are all part of that. When you put that all together, do you find, Patrick Poole, that what we're looking at is something akin to what's been happening in Europe, which is people coming into this country perhaps who are not necessarily jihadists but getting dropped off at the mosque, as it were, and becoming, in fact, full-fledged jihadists, perhaps of the civilization kind, perhaps of the violent kind?
Well, I think we're seeing the civilization jihad approach that we're getting more to the militant stage. And in fact, there was a very excellent report done by the AIVD, the Dutch intelligence service, called From Dawah to Jihad, that talks about the fact that, you know, it's one continuum. You know, it's hard to separate civilizational jihad from militant jihad, because they're all part of the same cycle. You know, if you don't comply with civilization jihad, then you get militant jihad, and that's what we're seeing in Europe. Is, you know, they're beginning to push back on the Islamization policies. At, you know, in these problematic areas in Belgium, in France, and now we see the French. I mean, of all people, you know, the French they've been picking up on how problematic this issue is in their interventions in Africa, particularly with Central African Republic. But now they're dealing with the problem internally, and we see reports that they're talking about closing down 100 mosques.
Well, and having raided some of them, found them armed to the teeth. Patrick, we're going to have to pause again. When we come back, let's talk a little bit further about the disarming of our own country, and then what we're seeing as a case study of the folly of this in Egypt. That will be the topic with Patrick Poole for our next segment right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Patrick Poole for a very special hour-long conversation about the state of jihad in America and what we ought to be learning from our friends and others overseas who are also being subjected to one kind or another of the jihad. And Patrick, one of the, well, I would like to say the gold standard, really, of counterterrorism in the United States for most of the period since 9/11 has been the New York Police Department, the NYPD, notably under its previous commissioner, Ray Kelly. Under a new commissioner, Bill Bratton, who actually had previously headed it up, and the present mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, we've seen a settlement recently with a sort of, well, what I think of as the red-green axis that had brought suit against the NYPD. Talk about that case, if you would, and what the implications are of that settlement for New York's finest.
Well, I think the most problematic element of that was the censorship of the radicalization report, which came out in 2007, which outlined the process and the organizations by which radicalization inside the Muslim community happens. And the bizarre thing is that as much as even the federal government wanted this report suppressed, but in fact a DOJ study, a Justice Department study, found exactly the exact same thing. So it's curious whether the Justice Department is going to, you know, censor itself on the findings of the radicalization process. And it's a, as you said, the NYPD has been undoubtedly the most vigilant in terms of its counterterrorism policies, and been very successful in that regard, even despite sometimes the federal authorities. And I do think immediate family members who are living in New York City that, the efforts to shut down with the NYPD to know what's happening in the community, you know, I'm not signing off on everything the NYPD was doing. And they have even said, look, you know, we were just, you know, trying to find out what was happening in these communities. I think it's going to end up getting New Yorkers killed.
One of the issues, Patrick, as you know, has been surveillance of the mosques and having NYPD personnel undercover in there just to monitor what's been going on. Given what we were just talking about France and what it's discovered, given what we've discussed so far in the program about several of these Muslim Brotherhood mosques, given what you know more generally about some of the favored speakers who are brought around, and including but not limited to Tariq Ramadan, Sarraj Wahaj, for example, people who are known to be advocates of jihad and working to bring others to it. Is this kind of surveillance not absolutely necessary, and not just in New York City, but elsewhere across the country?
Well, Frank, I think with respect to the surveillance issue is that what the proponents of no surveillance whatsoever, they're creating the conditions in which Muslims are going to be more under inspection, because we hear, you know, these advocates saying, you know, who basically use the Muslim community as a human shield for the extremists. And when something happens, much as it did after 9/11, when you know, most of the surveillance took place in New York, were the, you know, years immediately following that, is, you know, when the next event happens, then, you know, once again, it's going to be the entire Muslim community rather than these known hot spots of jihad. It's not rocket science. These nodes of radicalization, which the NYPD radicalization report talked about, like the Muslim Student Associations, you know, these mosques, you know, there's a mosque in Bay Ridge there in Brooklyn that's been problematic for years. And in fact, in one case, one of the parishioners went to the mosque, heard this extremist sermon, and then he went out and shot up a van full of Orthodox Jewish students, killing one on the Brooklyn Bridge back in the 90s. It's not a great mystery. And again, these advocates want to use the Muslim community as a human shield to prevent any, you know, any in-depth look into these extremist hotspots.
It makes, in a way, the larger point, Patrick, which would, I think you would agree, and that is, if we keep reaching out to the wrong Muslims, if we keep empowering them, if we keep legitimating them as the leaders of the community, there's much less space for Muslims who don't want to be part of any effort to impose Sharia in this country, don't want to live under it themselves, for that matter. to be effective alternatives or oppositions to this, and thereby create, as you say, problems probably for the community writ large. Patrick, before we run out of time, I do want to ask you about your insights into all of this arising from your in-depth reporting and investigative trips to Egypt. I think you've made two of them now, if I'm not mistaken. Give us sort of a flavor of where that most populous of Arab nations is at the moment, and whether the work that President al-Sisi has been engaged in against the Muslim Brotherhood and other extremists in his country is bearing fruit or is faltering, and our role in that matter.
Well, Frank, it's my experience in Egypt. I was there for most of September, and I'm about to head back. One of the amazing things is what we were just talking about, the elements within the Muslim community, I mean, who are concerned about the U.S. Obama administration policies and embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood. And we see this particularly over in Egypt, where you had the largest recorded protests in human history, 30 million people or more taking the streets to Egypt to overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood regime back in 2013. And it's a question I get asked by virtually every Egyptian I meet is, what is up with the U.S. Policies? I mean, we've gotten rid of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, Egypt is in an existential struggle against the Muslim Brotherhood right now. And, you know, why is the Obama administration continuing to embrace these people? I mean, they feel insulted that, hey, we got rid of these guys and you're still promoting them. You know, you still have these Muslim Brotherhood.